This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode 410 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Raquel M.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with chapter 6, entitled...
It's two words long.
I know, but I don't have it in front of me, so
it's if
I don't have it, I don't know
where all this stuff happens.
New York? I don't know.
Close. Long Island.
New Jersey?
Long Island.
Newfoundland?
Long
It's called
Island.
Long Island?
Yes.
Continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with chapter 6 entitled Long Island.
All right, there you go. So I got to say, this is not one of my favorite chapters.
Girl. It is. I want you to know.
Uh-oh.
That
you had to
I think that I've discovered the issue. I don't like how Diana Gabaldone writes late teen, early 20 people. I don't like them.
Well, that's
They're annoying.
Oh, okay, so that would be in common with his sister,
with Bree.
Right? Yeah,
because I didn't like Bree for like books. It took books to like Bree, and I didn't like William until the most recent book.
Oh, okay. Yeah, William has a lot of growing pains. I don't think I don't love him. I don't love anybody, but I don't think I appreciated him or started to really like him as a character until when he wasn't young. I definitely liked him in Moby, but I totally see what you're saying.
No, I didn't like him until he stopped being a d- about Jamie and his parentage.
Oh, that.
Like the second he started being like, I'm choosing my own path now. The second he stopped following, trying to do the
thing
to
that
be
was expected.
Everything that he was supposed to be for his stepfather, for the earldom, for all of those things. The second he stopped doing that and started making choices that
when he left the army,
yeah,
and went on to look for the people, the dead person who was maybe not dead, and getting into all the stuff, he stopped being a follower, basically.
Correct. So. And I think that because he started to actually think for himself, it felt like, which made him more interesting. So, but this is, I hated this. I hated it was an hour long by Davina, and I had to play it three times because I kept not listening.
This is what I didn't like about it. And that's funny you say that because I thought you were going to say the same thing I was thinking. You totally went somewhere else, which is completely valid. You wrapped it in with or being part and parcel with other times that you've had a hard time liking the character, namely younger Bree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's Diana's writing. Who knows? Although don't forget, they are brother and sister. So it could be Jamie's fault.
No, the common denominator is Diana, and she's written two young people the same way. And yes, they are both siblings, and yes, they have the same father, and yes, that could play into it. But that just means that I would find teenage Jamie really annoying too.
That's funny. That's
so
funny.
So please, no prequels of teen Jamie.
And I did not even think about any of that. The thing that I did not like, and I'm not saying it was a bad chapter. It's one of those things like, put it this way. It was one of those chapters that you have to get through. I have to make myself go through it. And when you're doing a read-along and you're reading it slowly and taking a lot of notes, I'm like, oh my God, I have to actually like force myself to do this. Like we're not going to skip a chapter. I know that. The reason I didn't really like it, even though it wasn't the most, because we've read books 7, 8, and 9. So we know that there are tons of descriptions that Diana gives of battles that are actually interesting, right? That are actually gripping. Like, I am not a war reader. Like, I don't want to, like, I don't hate war films. I just don't hate them. I just don't choose, like, they're not my genre. I don't go get war novels. I will say the only thing about quote unquote war novels, something that does interest me, is not the battles themselves. That's kind of what I mean. It's like, I'm not a big battle person. The things that get me are, especially World War II, because that's what I've read the most about, are the thing that that I do like war related to war, or at least one more that I've read a ton about, is
how sad it is.
No. I don't like it. Okay, Summer, you stop it right there. No. The books that I have loved have been, even if they're slight fiction or retelling of something, they're based on true people from history, namely during the time of World War II. And it's about either the French resistance or people from OES or the US who go in and train with the OES. I think that's the right. No, sorry. SS? Whatever. Not the SS. Sorry. It's whatever. Wow. The office of something, something in England.
You need to stop speaking German.
Sorry. In the UK. And they would then, of course, drop people by plane into, what's the word? Occupied France. And namely, so yes, they're spies.
That's two words.
Yes. Namely, people that would be, they had teams.
So you like espionage.
I think so, because you're not, it's just me reading about a battle on a battlefield, whether it's 18th century or 20th century, it's not that it can't be riveting. I'm sure I would find some accounts riveting and yes, tragic, but not in the good way. The thing that I like is when you get, is when you're reading about a person and you're following that person, or maybe a small group of people. For example, one book that is amazing and I really, 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 really recommend it. It's called The Nightingale, and it's based on, it is slightly fictionalized. Obviously, dialogue is fictionalized, but it is based on a true story of a woman. A female, whatever, a woman, a spy, or a woman who behind enemy lines, blah, 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 occupied France. I mean, to me, those are the most courageous, not the only ones, but those are the ones that really get me, because it, number one, it's usually, and I just realized, I forgot this part, it's kind of important. It's stories of women who were spies in occupied France, whether they were English and had, you know, some kind of like upbringing, like they were raised overseas or raised in France, but whatever it was, they spoke impeccable French, because otherwise, you know, if you don't speak fluently, obviously you're going to be found out and then murdered, whatever, shipped off to the Nazis. So anyway, all those books that I read are like edge of my seat. Like it's almost torturous to read them, because the authors, in my experience, have done such a good job of taking you in that. So would I enjoy a movie like that? I am sure. But when you have, and like I said, Diana, I have enjoyed several, maybe many, maybe most of Diana's own descriptions of battles that she's included, whether they're small skirmishes or big battles, whatever, that involve some of our beloved characters. Like there's one, I mean, it's kind of like at the end of a battle or a side battle. I don't know what to call it, but there's one. I'm not going to spoil it. There's one in Moby that involves a character you would not expect. And it is, it's torturous. It's torturous. So absolutely, I could enjoy battle scenes. Absolutely, I could enjoy, quote unquote, enjoy the tragedy of them. Yes, they can be expensive, exciting, but this chapter was none of those. And I didn't think, it's interesting you say that, I did not think about it being related to William. It very well could have been, because we're here in book seven. Book seven is really where we start to get to know William. Up until, because we did not see him at all, I think, in book six, right? Until near-ish toward the end, when Bree, Roger, and them all came to the coast to see what's his nuts be killed, right? Or executed. Did I lose you?
Right.
Like, no, please here. Don't tell me. Don't tell me I lost you. I can't go through that again. Oh, we will never finish this today if I lose you again. So anyway, we don't get William. We get William as a baby / young person in Voyager. We get him in book four, right? When he comes and visits on the ridge and falls into the privy, or he's like 12 or something. I don't know that we get him at all in book five. I don't remember. I could be wrong, but I don't remember.
We barely had John Gray in the last book.
Oh, I know. Oh, well, yeah. Exactly.
And he kept sending Higgins.
Yeah, that's true. And in book six, I don't think we have him. He may be in more than one scene, but I don't think he's not a big figure. He's not a major figure. We don't see him. So basically, we don't see or hear much of or from William We don't see him between the ages of 12 and like 1920.
And 12 and asshole.
That's funny. So yeah. So we're here with William. We probably should actually start the chapter.
I thought this was the full discussion.
It could be, actually. Here's the thing. This is what's hard for me. I can't say regardless because it's all looped in together. I don't think I had a hard time with the chapter necessarily because of William. And I don't think I would have had a hard time if it was like a chapter of a battle, right? To me, this chapter, I was trying to find the point of the chapter. I was like, okay, it started out with some dates. And I'm like, oh, okay, those are kind of important. They're like setting the scene. Fine, I'll take notes of dates. And then it was describing these troops. And then troops. And then it was describing these troops. And then we get William. And da 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 da. And I'm like, I don't know what to write down. I don't know what to write down. Like, what is important from this chapter? There's not a lot of dialogue that explains a story that we need to know, that we need to know for later. That's what I'm saying. I think it's one of those chapters you have to just get through. If you enjoyed it, God bless you, because this was hard for me. So let's go.
You know what's making this hard for me?
The fact that I'm not starting?
This makes me think. No. It just makes me think of all the people that you meet at an older age. It makes me think like Back to the Future, because like,
oh,
the people that, like, I didn't meet my boyfriend until he was in his 40s and I was in my 30s. Like, we didn't meet until then. And I'm like, if I went back in time, I don't think I would have liked him because the stories I've heard of who he was then. And I was just like, so going back and reading this now, I'm like, William, you're better than this.
But he doesn't know that. So you got to give him that.
Okay. I know.
So Diana, even though it's not a letter, she doesn't only do it in letters. She does it in a lot of chapters. She tries to set the scene with whenever possible, with a date and a location, or at least one of the two. So we get a lot of dates at the beginning. So Diana gives us kind of a little bit of a history lesson or reminders. So July 4th, 1776 is the Declaration of Independence. It is signed in Philadelphia. July 24th, Lieutenant General Sir William Howe arrives in Staten Island and he sets up his headquarters at the Rose and Crown Tavern. Now, I am wondering, it's just like the U.S. and by the U.S., I mean the former colonies, like the 13, right? The early U.S. It would be just like them/us to have, even if it's not the same paint on the walls, for that tavern to still exist. I mean, it should. Anyway, August 13th, so about 3 weeks later, Lieutenant General George Washington arrives in New York to reinforce fortifications, which the Americans held. So they held that city or that area. About a week later, August 21st, William Ransom, Lieutenant Lord Ellesmere, arrived at the Rose and Crown. Remember that it's a tavern, reporting for duty as the newest member of General Howe's staff. The next day, 8:22. So August 22nd, the day after William arrives, I guess it makes sense. Okay. I was trying to think, this doesn't make sense. So William arrives at the Rose and Crown Tavern.
Guildenstein are dead.
Thank you. I was going that direction. So on the 21st, William arrives as the newest member of General Howe's staff. On the 22nd, I'll just read what I wrote and then I'll say what I think it means. On the 22nd, the next day, William isn't doing great. He's on a boat and seasick. And there's something about sucking on someone's pickle.
Yeah, I did enjoy that little bit.
Me too.
I thought it was funny, mostly because it was one of those things where I was like, that really is a genetic thing.
Oh,
that luckily,
yes,
Bree didn't get.
Right?
But
I never thought about that, but that's true.
But William is 100% afflicted with the exact same seasickness problem as his daddy.
And once they came ashore, so obviously he's on a boat of some kind, he was excited for his first real battle. Now, the thing that I had a hard time like coming to terms with or thinking like, wait, I'm so confused. On the 21st, Diana tells us he arrives at this tavern as part of General Howe's staff. And the next day, he's on a boat. So my guess is they met at a certain place to report. He meant to report somewhere.
Yeah.
And then he's
like
put on a boat.
A rendezvous point.
Exactly. And then he's put on a boat with other troops, whatever, to go to the place where they're going to confront the troops or something like that.
Correct.
So
he had to get his assignments.
It was a little, exactly. So it was a little confusing to me. But again, I'm not a military person. I'm not a troopy person. I don't know a lot about that. So I'm a little dense
sometimes. Did you say troopy person?
I did.
Troopy?
So the troops are all making their way to shore. So this is from the boat that William's just on. And he was supposed to be borrowing someone's horse. He also has, at this point, he has four companies under him. And he was unfamiliar with these companies because he hadn't, like, they were just assigned. And from what he has seen, though, he's not impressed.
He seems to have lots of issues with horses.
Oh, Summer, we can't say too much right now, but I will say...
I know. I'm just saying. I'm noticing it now as it begins.
No. You're not wrong. What I'm saying is there's something I want... This is not about you. It's about me. This is something I want to say.
Okay.
Which is confirmatory. Confirm. I want to freaking confirm what you're saying, but say more, but okay. I can't.
Okay.
But because of what you said, maybe we go back to when he was 12. When a 12-year-old-ish William falls into a privy... Right? Covered in poo and sewage and almost killed by a snake, but he's not. Gross.
Exactly.
Is that, and I'm making a joke here, could that be a portent for later on? Meaning, he's got some, he has some troubles in this chapter, and that's all we're talking about today. But, and this is, I'm not going to spoil anything, but let me just tell you, William's troubles do not end in this chapter.
To be fair.
They become pretty redonkulous later on in the book.
To be fair, he does, in fact, follow after his birth father in that way.
Jamie?
Oh, yeah. Everything. He gets clopped in. Jamie has all the worst luck.
Well, I guess so.
Like, he gets clobbered in the head by his uncle, and then he finds Claire and they do that whole thing. He's forced to marry her. He doesn't mind it. And then he gets kidnapped by the troops while he was in the river looking for whatever. And then
that's
beaten
true.
Again.
That's
then he
true.
Gets all of his fingers broken and raped by Captain Jack Blandell. Like, seriously, she tortures her men. I said Blandell, and I know that's not right.
But I know what you're saying, but you said, blah, 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 blah. I lost it. I forgot.
Jamie has bad luck too. I'm just saying they both
That's
have
true.
Really not great luck.
Fair enough.
Because the only difference between them having a better time is honestly luck. They're doing all the right things. So it is just the fact that the other stars aren't aligning the way that they could. And because they aren't aligning in the way that they could, he is experiencing all of these bad luck. So
you could argue
that
saying. The two times he has the worst trouble in this chapter, he actually has luck, not for getting into the trouble, but not for getting into worse trouble. Okay, so they're on the boat. He's seasick. He refuses to suck someone's pickle.
I mean, even if it was, it's an actual pickle is the thing.
It is an actual pickle.
However, I think that if anyone presented it to anyone else like that, they would say no thank you too.
I mean, yeah, of course.
Because one, I don't want to suck on somebody's penis that I, you know, whatever,
don't,
if that's
that,
what
that
he's
you
implying,
don't know.
One. Two,
no, I, think
I don't
want to
suck on somebody else's pickle. Like, why would you put somebody else's food in your mouth? That's gross. Yeah,
it is
That's
gross.
Like sharing a toothbrush.
Of a stop. So Lord John had told William about General Howe, the general that William is working under. And he says that Howe is very cautious, sometimes maybe even, you know, borderline too cautious. And then William sees the horse that he's borrowing. His horse arrives and he has brought his spontoon or a half pike. And I had to look that up because I heard the words, but I couldn't envision it. And it's basically it's a half pike. It's like a pike. Long, but this one's really fancy and made of shiny metal. It was the thing that they had in their arms or in their hands when you're on the battlefield that you raise to give the soldiers their signals. That's what he had. So he was to be part of the second wave of troops in the upcoming battle. He guides his troops. He begins to guide his troops into battle just after noon. William has lots of internal thoughts. I don't need to capture them. Like, I try to stick to just the facts of, like, the actual events happening because, like I said, this chapter wasn't awful, but this was not the easiest chapter. This is probably one of the most difficult chapters, not thematically, but, like, this is drudgery as opposed to something being difficult because of, you know, tragedy or harm or abuse, right? Like hard to read because someone's being hurt. No. This was just freaking hard to read. Not hard to read like I couldn't read it. It was hard to, like Summer said, I had to force myself to get through. It was hard. It was not easy. I didn't enjoy it, put it that way. So he has lots of internal thoughts. I did not write them down, so we're not going to go over them. But mostly about him being proud to be back in uniform, happy for the chance to finally lead in battle, and he's on the lookout for Americans. He also thinks about his recent journey and wonders when he might meet Captain Richardson, to whom he was supposed to turn over the results of his intelligencing, or which means, of course, is a spy, sometimes part-time spy. It's spy work. Most things that he had gathered, most of the things that he had were committed to memory, but some of it had been written in code in a small copy of the New Testament he carried. And he's thinking about making, he's like, should I put this into a proper report, like with footnotes and everything? And as he's thinking this, he hears the sound of a musket. And he sees a different group of troops, British troops, return fire. And then there were a few volleys back and forth. This went on all afternoon. So remember, he's just sitting here thinking about things. And then the sound of a musket takes him out of his thoughts. And he's there now watching this battle that he's now a part of. Later, they march. They were meant to march or meant to march. They march through the night. And he has his men sing for a little bit. It helps people stay awake. They get to the shore by dawn. And then another battle breaks out. Now, over the next 2 days, William, there's so little sleep. And it's excitement and also, you know, high stakes, right? It's battle. So he wasn't sure where he was. Meaning, like, I guess geographically, he knew, like, he knows where his troops are. They're right with him or whatever. But he finally gets to see some Continentals, so some American troops. And he was excited. And also, William was in charge of the battle that was around the stone house. So there's a stone house that I believe that some of the British were inside and trying to capture or trying to take over. And there were fights between Americans and British over basically, it kind of went back and forth several times. Like they would kind of capture the house and then lose it, capture the house and then lose it. That went on a few times. Yeah, that was that was pages. Like that does not need to be pages. While his horse was trained for musket fire, meaning it wouldn't freak out, right? It was, I don't know the right term. Linnea would know the right term, but it was trained. It was a battle horse trained for loud noises, right? Not to dump its rider, not to escape, not to buck, all of that. But it was not trained for artillery fire. So when the cannons went off, it bolted and left William on the ground. So now he has no horse.
Like I said, worst luck with horses.
Which is interesting because Jamie does not. Jamie has great. Not to say that William's bad with horses, but Jamie has better. Jamie, like, he's a natural horseman. Yeah.
Well, but he's also better at picking horses.
Well, that's true. But William didn't get a chance to choose. He was given a horse.
No, he didn't. But he's not good at. I think that
there's a lot of things he's not good at.
Jamie could get on any horse and figure it out. You know what I mean? But William is more like, I have a horse. This horse is my horse. And we've established this bond and we know how to work together. Whereas he's like, new horse, who dis? You know what I mean?
I was about to say, you better go there. Okay. So they do make camp that night. And the generals are discussing the next battle plans. And William is brought into this tent where the big head honchos are sitting there and, around the table, I guess, and talking. And he's like the lowest person on the pole. I can't say totem pole, and I think honcho is also bad. Wait, honcho is Spanish. Still may not be great, but I don't think it's Native American. Or honcho may be Mexican, so maybe it is Native American. I don't know. But I know that totem pole is not great to say. So he's lowest on the importance rung. I don't know. He's a green officer, put it that way. He's green compared to the big important people in the room. He's standing back kind of against the wall of the tent. And General Howe says that we need to stop the fighting. And then he looks up and he fingers William. He does not finger William.
No.
He asks William to if he had any observations to make. So basically, tell me. He points him out. He chooses him. He's like, look, little dude, or not so little dude, but new dude. Do you have anything to say? Anything to share? And William says, well, it's General Putnam who's in command of the American troops. And it appears that I believe General Putnam is pretty stubborn. And he says that in Boston, he believes the Americans didn't leave, meaning they didn't leave the battlefield, until they'd used every bit of their ammunition. But he doesn't think that's the case here. He thinks there is someone behind Putnam here. Now, he doesn't go on more than that. He says he thinks all the Continentals are on the island, meaning Long Island. He has to explain, because he's pressed for this, he has to explain how he knows it's Putnam. And he shares that he'd seen the wooden button, I believe, on one of the dead Continental's uniform that had carved into it P-U-T. So it was one of Putnam's men. And he shares that he just arrived from a spy expedition. And while he was out or there, whatever, he'd heard that militia were gathering to accompany General Putnam, who was to join Washington near New York. And then he mentions the dead rebel with the button. And he said, and he knows that Putnam or the men were calling him Old Putt, or I'm guessing Old Putt. And so Howe decides they are not going to offer terms, but they will stop fighting. And he hopes, and he says, hopefully the Americans would then do an unconditional surrender. But if not, .. William clarifies. He's like, that's not what I meant. I don't think there's more truth behind the Americans. I believe Putnam is covering another army's retreat. So he, when I said he has people behind him, I mean he's freaking protecting them. So then Howe has someone take William to be debriefed. And the fighting is suspended, meaning, or paused, I guess. And Captain Ramsey, who I think is doing the debrief, or as they're walking to take him to be debriefed, William's like, I had to, like, should I have not said that? And Captain Ramsey's all, well, you were asked a direct question. You had to respond. But he says, it's not very popular to be a Cassandra. So you had to do what you had to do. But just like, just know that there may be people who don't take kindly to you sharing that information. Later, William is supposed to report to a General Clinton. Now, there was fog and he couldn't see much. So as he's trying to make it the right direction, he has to ask for directions. And he follows these instructions. It's out. It's very, very willy-nilly. This, I think it Perkins or whoever gave him the directions said, basically, you go out toward this hillock. I mean, in the fog, how does that help, right? But he's going and going, and he never comes across this thing that he would consider a hillock. And he realizes after a while that he hasn't heard the sound of men for quite a bit. So getting a little testy, getting a little, you know, anxious, he has his pistol ready. The fog is only getting thicker. And after an hour or more of walking aimlessly, someone steps out in front of him and freaks out his horse. So he's on a horse, but the horse is walking aimlessly. They're together walking aimlessly. So the horse is freaked out. And then someone grabs William from the horse from behind and pulls him down off the horse. And they begin to beat him. Someone steals his gorget, the silver thing around his neck. And the other men take the horse.
You just pronounce that like
three times.
Cucumber.
Huh?
Or zucchini.
Oh, courgette.
Yeah.
They take his gorget and his horse and of course all of his weapons or whatever, and they leave him. But they hadn't gone yet, because one grabs the hair, pulls back his head, and cuts off his ponytail. So I mean, that's only for humiliation. That there is no, I mean, maybe there's money to be made by selling that at that point in time. Like, look who I got.
He's not
from
Fontaine.
I know. And so William is not only angry at this entire thing.
He's got a bad haircut. Poor William.
And he has a bad haircut, but he's also embarrassed because he'd been taken so easily. Quote,
mm-hmm. And his he now rage, has a bad haircut.
His rage was so overwhelming that he had to stop and punch a tree trunk, unquote. Now, does that sound familiar?
How stupid typical is it of a man?
Of a doodle. Yeah.
To be like, I'm so angry, I just need to punch something. And I'm going to find something that's going to hurt me more than I can hurt it.
Exactly. So he's lost in the wilds of Long Island, but now with no horse, food, or weapons, or hair. He needs to find any part of the army.
Just any part.
Any part. And he remembers the conversation he had had with Lord John about killing in or near a battle time. And he remembers Lord John, who had shared that his first kill was of a wounded Jacobite after Culloden. And he says to William, I wish I hadn't done the killing. And William said, yeah, but father, papa, whatever you called him, you had to. It was your order. And he said, well, I was not part of the army. I was there following my brother. I was not under anyone's command.
I was 16.
And I could have chosen, and I was really young. I could have chosen. His whole point was, and even if he were an officer, even if he were part of the army, he says, quote, "You always have a choice, William," unquote.
And when you have the choice, always let Jamie Fraser go.
Unless you can get his pickle.
And then show up at convenient times and be his personal Lord and Savior.
Pickle holder.
Pickle holder, stop.
Oh, so he continues to walk, climb, all the stuff. And he experiences vertigo in this gray fog. And I got to tell you, I guess dizziness is the same as vertigo, whatever. I've experienced that driving. If everything is gray, like because the roads are black or gray, right? If it's foggy and, you know, like rainy or whatever, everything, literally everything you see out the sides, out the front is gray. And even though I can look down and see, like, if I'm wearing red pants, I see that I'm wearing red pants. And I know I'm like, I know I'm sitting up. I know gravity is working, but it really does a number on your inner ear, on your brain. It just freaks you out. And I have to sometimes, I have had to in the past pull over because and I'll turn the AC on just to get some, I mean, fresh air, just cool air, at least me. Once I'm in that kind of, it kind of feels like a, not a spin, but like your head is almost turning. I don't get afraid. Like I'm not afraid of a thing. Like I'm in danger or in trouble. I mean, yeah, I don't want to crash, but it's, I know it's not a fear. It's just, it feels, I feel sick. And because of that, I want to make sure that I don't make, you know, bad, not choices really, but don't make bad moves because of me not being able to perceive my environment correctly.
You don't need any help.
You shut your mouth. You mean like falling and stuff or toes?
No, I just mean driving. You don't need bad help.
Okay. But they're long.
They're long.
Long as
they're monkey toes. They just aren't shaped like my toes.
They're so I think monkey toes. That is the rudest thing you've ever said.
Why? I have monkey toes.
Yeah.
Because I can pick things up with them.
Well, okay. I can do that too.
Exactly. You have monkey toes too.
So.
I call them my tingers.
What? Oh, your toe finger? Mm-hmm. I don't think you're saying tingles. I'm like, no. So he's walking and walking and walking, just trying to like find anyone and anything that he can recognize. And he hears sounds of men and horses still in the gray fog. But it didn't sound like an army. And later he realizes he'd reached the sea. And what he's hearing is, yes, people, but also boats scratching on the maybe not the sand, but on the rocks or whatever as they are pushed out to sea. And he hears the people among them. And he hears them talking and whispering. And he was pretty sure he was on the western side of the island. And if so, it was the Americans he was hearing. And so this probably would have been part of that thing he was describing, right? The retreat. And then someone commands William not to move.
Don't move.
And then he hears another person. And he's like, oh, well, it's more than one person then. And we find out to his embarrassment, he'd been captured by a pair of old women. One of them smoking a pipe.
As you do.
And one of them, they'd bound him, his hands behind his back. And then one of the, because remember, he's still wearing his red coat jacket. Yes. And a continental dude, one of the dudes getting on a boat, you know, starting to head out. And the women talk back to him. He's like, they're trying to actually, believe it or not. So they're the ones who captured him, right? They take prisoner of him, whatever, and they tie him up. But they also see the continental and they're like, you know what? He's just a boy. There's nothing to see here. You know, move on. And once he leaves, they untie William and urge him to go.
They're all, we made a mistake.
But by now, the sun is finally out and he will be able to navigate, he believes, back to his troops. But as he's walking away, he had seen the man, the Continental, who had seen him and was gone, what had been looking at him the entire time. As his boat, from the boat he was on that was going out to sea, was watching William the entire time. And he, we don't get a chunk of time. I think Diana says it's a long time. So for a while, he feels these eyes on the back of his neck, back, whatever, head. And as he begins to walk, he remembers what Captain Ramsay had said. Quote, heard of a lady called Cassandra? Now, we don't have evidence other than, I mean, you can make a connection to yourself if you want. If you know, we didn't talk about this yet. But here, of course, Cassandra is referring to the figure in Greek mythology who's basically like an oracle.
A psychic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The oracle at Delphi.
Seer.
So she wasn't, I would say more of a seer. And so if you ever hear someone saying, oh, well, she's a, you know, making fun of something or referring to someone or something as a Cassandra, it is someone who tells the future or someone who, you know, maybe predicts,
and it's usually
predicts
not
things.
Good.
Oh, yeah, it's usually not wonderful. So that made me think, even though I can't connect those two old women to Ramsay or Howe or anyone there, the fact that Diana brings it back to us at the end of the chapter, it makes one think if this was, even if it wasn't planned, if this was so-called revenge for quote unquote showing up or some of those generals at the meeting with Howe.
Maybe.
Say too.
And that, my friends and listeners, was chapter 6. Join us next time when we will be continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with Chapter 7, An Uncertain Future, and Chapter 8, Spring Thaw.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Raquel M. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon and maybe even become a co-producer, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, maybe meet some like-minded Outlander-loving individuals, please join us in our group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code Outlander20, Outlander20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Outlander Pod.
I dreamt it last night.